Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, this is great. I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. Welcome to White Coat Black Heart. Long before I became a physician, I was an NHL hockey fan. This week, I get to indulge my passion for both and meet a hero. They're concerned about the height differential.
Oh, I see.
Yes. You would have been the tallest person in your class.
Yeah.
Today, Dr. David Mulder is 6'5" and a giant in so many other ways.
Let the record show that I'm short.
As team physician to the Montreal Canadiens, Mulder stitched up countless players through 9 Stanley Cups. But he didn't just witness NHL hockey. He helped make it safer. When he wasn't at the Montreal Forum or the Bell Centre, he was saving lives as a chest surgeon here at the Montreal General Hospital. And when he wasn't doing that, he was helping modernize trauma care in Quebec. This week, he retires from his post as team doctor with the Canadiens. Our conversation is one hell of an exit interview.
All right, that works.
Ça marche.
Okay. Hi, my name is Dave Mulder. I'm a thoracic surgeon at the Montreal General Hospital, and I've been doing it since 1963.
You ended up with the Montreal Canadiens in 1969. But you started with the Junior Canadians in 1963. That's a long, long time. Dr. David Mulder, welcome to White Coat Black Arc.
Thank you.
You're a thoracic surgeon. So how did you come to being a physician for a hockey team?
So I was lucky one day. I met Dr. Kinnear. That was in September of 63. And I was a rookie general surgeon. And he said, I've just taken over care for the Montreal Canadiens. And I have to need somebody to help me look after the Montreal Junior Canadians. And in those days, they played every Sunday at the old Forum. The place was sold out. It was no helmets, no mask, lots of lacerations. So it was a tyro surgeon's delight. We often sutured up as many as 10 or 12 lacerations in a game. So that's how I got started. And so I went to after the juniors, I went to the Voyageurs. They were the American League team. And then after that, in 1969, he accepted me to be the assistant to Dr. Kinnear, looking after the big team.
So he actually took you from Junior A to the American Hockey League to just like a hockey player. Yeah. You've already mentioned the lack of safety equipment. Like what safety equipment existed at that time when you started out?
I would say none. They wore no helmets, no masks, no visors. They had shin pads and shoulder pads, and I think those are the basics.
You look at the photos of goalies that played then, back then, so Gump Worsley and Terry Sawchuk, Glenn Hall, Johnny Bower, the ones who played without a mask. You see the cuts, and you said you sewed up a lot of those cuts?
Yeah. For sure, many. That was our common thing. We had a clinic at the old Forum right off the ice surface, and so we sewed them up right away and got them back on the ice.
Which was probably the value in having a thoracic surgeon, slick with sutures and a needle driver.
You know, some of the junior Canadians, when I see them now, they say, Doc, you were practicing on us, and I guess that's true.
You made it to the big leagues. You moved up to the NHL with the Habs, with the Montreal Canadiens in 1969. What did you see? What were your marching orders? What did you see as your job at that time?
To get the players back on the ice as quickly as possible.
And then, of course, you've got the prime rule of the Hippocratic Oath, which is to do no harm.
Exactly.
Did the two ever come into conflict with one another?
I think probably, but... You know, my best teacher in this whole effort was my idol, Jean Béliveau. And he said to me, you know, always remember when you're treating a patient, the goal is to do what's best for the patient.
He told you that.
He told me that, and he said, as a rookie, and he said, ignore the press, ignore management, and ignore the fans, and do what's best for the player. Probably the single most important bit of advice I ever received.
And you got it early.
Yeah, in my early years.
How else did Jean Béliveau help you get along with the players on the team?
Well, he was always very kind to me and introduced me to the players. And I think that maybe the best example of how he influenced me was on one occasion, John Ferguson had been in a fight and knocked out. And it was probably when we were becoming more aware of concussions. So I said to John Ferguson, you've got to sit the rest of the game out. And he started objecting, I would say, and got pretty violent. And Béliveau came along and said, don't fight with him, Doc. And I said, okay, so you talk. So he said, let me handle it. So he taught me an important lesson. He put him in the clinic and locked the door, and then the game went on. And so he said, don't have a confrontation. Good advice.
Probably another really good piece of advice. Was it that your gut told you he shouldn't come back? There wasn't a lot of science to concussions back then. No,
well, that was a time where we'd had some warnings about concussions, and we were getting concerned about concussions, no question. A long time ago when I was young and innocent, I suggested that the McGill University give Jean Béliveau an honorary degree. And they didn't laugh me out of the room, but almost. But I'd written a letter, and so time went by, 5 or 10 years, I guess, and a new McGill principal, Heather Munro Bloom, called, and she said, I found this old letter here suggesting that Jean Béliveau be given an honorary degree. She said, do you still hold by it? And I said, I certainly do. And so it was one of the most amazing experiences in my life that he was so impressed by it. You know what their biggest worry was? That he wouldn't be able to give a good address to the graduates. He gave a 10-minute address, which, you know, stunned them. And you know what he talked about is leadership and team player. And it was sensational. And so I've never forgotten it.
You had to deal in your capacity as team doctor with the aftermath of some incredibly brutal injuries, and I'm thinking, I'm thinking about 2011 when Zdeno Chara hit Max Pacioretty into a metal stanchion.
Zone. Oh, Pacioretty is down face first as Chara angled him, and Pacioretty was lined up against the center glass between the two benches.
Yes, and we took him off the ice, and he sustained injuries to the head and brain, and more importantly, had fractures of his cervical spine.
Max Pacioretty is being mobilized now after they have strapped him to the backboard.
The important thing about my relationship with the team is that it was based at the Montreal General Hospital, and it's a trauma center. It's very close, and if you look at the history, proximity to the hospital is a big factor. And so that saved things that day.
Like, as a team doctor, would you have your eyes on the ice at all times? What would you be looking at?
No, we sat right behind the bench. As a result of previous injuries, the NHL has mandated now that the doc be 25 to 50 feet from the clinic. And so the injury happened right in front of us. And at that time, the stanchions were square and metal, and now they're rounded and protected. So all of that is a result of the Pacioretty incident.
You must have wondered if he'd ever play again.
I did, and the interesting thing that his mom and dad were at that game. And so, you know, we met them later on in the waiting room outside after we dealt with them in the emergency room and talked things over with them. And lo and behold, a distant aunt had been a nurse at the MGH, and so there was an immediate connection. And I think that kind of relationship is critical and it's key, and I'm sure led to the fact that after he got better, Max raised the funding to buy us a new MRI, several million dollars.
He would have had an MRI that night.
Yes.
Certainly an unforgettable moment, an unforgettable injury. Happened in January 2000.
Trent McCleary blocks the slap shot, and the puck makes a direct hit on McCleary's neck.
The Canadians were playing the Philadelphia Flyers, and Trent McCleary takes a puck to the throat at very high speed. Did you see it when it happened?
Yeah, no, we saw it. We were in the same seats, and it was right directly across from me. You know, they called us to come on the ice, but by the time we were just opening the gate, and they had brought him over to the edge of the ice surface, and then he sort of collapsed in our arms, and we took him into the emergency clinic where we tried to control an airway. And we originally thought we might need to put do a cricothyroid or put a needle in his neck, but using ATLS techniques of
Advanced Trauma Life Support, which is an algorithmic kind of standardized approach to managing trauma patients.
Maybe the most encouraging sound I ever heard was when I did the jaw thrust and I heard a squeaky breath.
Strider. We call it Strider when there's so you actually did a jaw thrust, you did a jaw lift.
Is it probably reduced the fracture of the larynx? Mm-hmm. And so then we were, what to do? Should we try and do a tracheostomy there? And we made the decision. I had another surgeon who came out of the crowd to help me, and we decided we'd go to the Montreal General.
McCleary, who came within minutes of dying, was transported to a Montreal hospital where.
So we phoned the hospital. We said, we aren't going to stop in the emergency department. We said, we're going right to the OR. And the guys who were in the clinic at the Bell Center phoned ahead. And then we could breathe a little easier. And then we went on and did a tracheostomy. And then he had a laryngeal reconstruction. One of the ear, nose, and throat surgeons reconstructed his larynx the next day.
Well, the 27-year-old was said to be awake and alert and even scribbled a note to his teammates saying he's, quote, doing great.
Was that your closest brush with death?
No question. It was life-threatening. And fortunately, we'd do simulations all the time. We'd had practice in the ABCs, as you know, of trauma, and that saved our lives that day.
Let's give credit to your colleague who came down from the stands to assist you, Dr. David Fleischer. David Fleischer, yeah, a general surgeon.
General surgeon, and we've been colleagues in trauma for years and years, so he knew the trouble we were in, but you have to remember that element of luck. It was Super Bowl Sunday. It was a light snow. There was no traffic. Everybody's watching the football game, and so we were at the general in shorter time than I could imagine, and the OR was quiet. The anesthetist, he was probably watching the football game too. He was readily available. We had the phone call alert, so he was there when we got off the elevator.
I'm thinking about the awesome decision that you just described making, which was not doing an emergency airway at the arena, but going lights and sirens to the hospital. That could have gone the other way.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we still talk about it. We have the equipment to do a cricothyroid, which is a little easier than a trach, but we have the equipment to do both there, but it's in the hockey arena. Doesn't have all the facilities that are, most of all, it doesn't have an anesthesiologist.
And Trent recovered. Flash forward to September of that year, when he's come back to training camp, I guess against a lot of odds. Describe the moment you had to sit Trent down and tell him you were pulling his medical clearance.
Well, it was, I think it was a joint decision, but it was, he'd worked hard all summer to get into shape like all players do. And he actually played the first game, or part of the first game, but he had no respiratory reserve. He was short of breath. He couldn't play 30 seconds even shift. So after the game, we sat down and talked and said, "This isn't going to work. This is and I don't." And we had previous we'd done pulmonary function tests, and had an otolaryngologist seen him, and we knew it was borderline. And so it wasn't a shock to him that we were going to. That we told him we couldn't let him play any further.
How many times have you had to do that?
Oh, quite a few. Sometimes it's just not playing for a game. I remember Chris Nyland when we were winning the Stanley Cup in Calgary, and he had a bad sprained ankle, and I didn't let him play. And I mean, again, it was almost came to fisticuffs. He was so keen to play. And that's a hard thing. That's a really, because as a physician, you want to get them back as soon as you can.
How did Trent's injury lead to changes in medical care in the NHL?
Well, that was maybe one of the most important things, because the NHL made it mandatory that the doctor be sitting 25 to 50 feet from the clinic. So that automatically meant you're right behind the bench. And it's two seats that they can't sell. Everybody agreed on the importance, and it's now the way it is throughout the league. So his injury has maybe saved many lives since.
We'll be right back.
Hi there, I'm Gavin Crawford. I'm a writer, an actor, and a comedian. And for the last 8 or 9 years, I have been navigating life with my mother's increasing dementia. Has it been sad? Yeah. Has it been funny? Also, yeah. That's what my brand new podcast series, Let's Not Be Kidding, is about. It's the true story of my life as a comedian, my mom, and dementia. Let's Not Be Kidding, with me, Gavin Crawford. A new 7-part series from CBC Podcasts, available now.
You're listening to White Coat Black Art. This week, a conversation with behind-the-scenes hockey legend, Dr. David Mulder. He's retiring after more than half a century as the Montreal Canadiens' team doctor. Off the ice, he helped modernize how doctors and hospitals in Quebec respond to patients involved in car collisions and other traumas, saving countless lives. Mulder also played a significant role in another kind of trauma, two that took place at École Polytechnique in 1989 and at Dawson College in 2006. I'm going to take a step away from hockey for a second. As an emergency physician myself, I can't kind of let you go without asking you something else. You know, you're part of NHL history, but you're also part of Montreal history. I understand you treated victims of both the École Polytechnique massacre in 1989 and the shooting in 2006. Most Canadians know a lot about both as historical events, but you have a unique insider perspective that almost none of us have. Can you share some of that?
It was I remember them both vividly. And with École Polytechnique, we had many penetrating injuries reached the hospital at the same time.
14 students dead, all women. Another dozen people were hurt, caught in a rampage that witnesses called a human hunt, with the gunman yelling, "I want women."
I took the first patient to the operating room, and she had a penetrating injury to her bowel, and we resected the bowel, and then we operated all evening that night, I think 6 to 8 hours, with 5 or 6 surgeons involved. It was a heroic thing.
That horrible event led to changes.
Yeah. And police go in right away. If there's a known shooter, here the police all stayed outside. And I think at that time that was a conventional wisdom, that they not go in for fear of getting shot themselves and so on. Now they go in and at Dawson, they disarmed the shooter right away.
10,000 students attend this English language college that brings back memories for so many of us of the École Polytechnique massacre. This is eerily familiar. We are hearing, however, that there is one distinct difference in this case, and that there are at least 2 gunmen, both dead. One neutralized by police, one who took his own life. But
a good lesson learned.
A lesson that apparently still needs to be learned in the United States.
Yes.
They don't always go in. They're supposed to, but
yeah,
we know.
The last one in Texas, really bothered me. Yeah. I mean, they probably lost lives because of it. And that gets at the bigger problem. We need to do something about gun control.
What more needs to happen for that to change?
No one needs an automatic, a semi-automatic or an automatic wartime weapon. You know, these assault rifles are, we don't need them for hunting or and I think, I grew up on a farm. I know how to handle a gun better than probably anybody. and farmers can keep their guns. They're not going to shoot anybody. And so, I mean, I think we need to have some common sense gun policy. The sooner the better.
You've had a trauma center named after you here at the Montreal General Hospital where you work. You were one of the forces helping to restructure trauma care in Quebec. What did you do?
Well, that's a good question. All my life I've been involved with trauma, and so I became a member of the American Association for Trauma Surgery. The thing I learned about in the United States was that they developed the concept of trauma centers, where instead of going to the nearest hospital, you went to a hospital that could deal with major trauma. And Canada had none of this. I looked at mortality in Quebec, and I found that for equivalent injury, the mortality in Quebec was 50% compared to the United States, 7 or 8%. So I went to the then Minister of Health with a colleague from the U.S., who is very well respected for trauma, and a colleague from one of our French hospitals. And we met with Marc Yvan Côté, who was the Minister of Health then. The night before our meeting, a cabinet minister rolled his car and had a seatbelt on and had a seatbelt laceration of the neck and died in the ditch. And so we brought that, he understood right away what we were talking about. And we talked about how many trauma centers there should be in Quebec. And so he bought the idea, and you can't imagine how quickly it was introduced. And I think it was 5 or 6 or 7 years later, the mortality in Quebec had gone from 50% to down to 10% and is now probably below 8%, probably at 6% in Quebec. Quebec has now got a good reputation in terms with trauma centers in Montreal, Sherbrooke, and Quebec City. It's been, in terms of healthcare prevention, it's been monumental. And I still have one thing that hasn't been done. And I can't sleep over it. Did you know that Quebec is the only province in Canada that doesn't have a helicopter system for medical evacuation? And so that's my project now. We're trying to get, and maybe haven't been a good salesman, but we haven't succeeded yet.
You would think that the results would speak for themselves.
Well, look at the results in Saskatchewan with the Humboldt Bronco tragedy, where many were killed on the roadside, but three helicopters at the roadside taking them to Saskatoon and Regina. We can't do that. Think of the movie star who is at Tremblant had a...
Natasha Richardson.
Yes.
I was thinking of her as you were talking about
and
that.
And if she'd had a helicopter and been transported to a level one trauma center, her life would have been saved.
You mentioned briefly concussions, and I want to get back to that. How has the response to concussions changed over time with the Canadians?
Oh, I think it's changed dramatically from, for instance, 63 to now. It's now the equipment is improved. The hockey ruling has improved. The medical care is better. Imaging is so much better. I can get someone over here and do a CT scan in 10 or 15 minutes from the arena. Teaching is better. There's a much more conservative attitude. You know, the saying, if in doubt, set them out, now takes over. So there's never any, and management don't question it anymore. So we've made progress. We're not there yet. I guess what I would like to see is that fighting was out of question or was disallowed. But that's not a very popular thought. My view is that the goal of a fight is to produce a concussion. It's to create a brain injury.
A lot of people watching the game don't understand that it's not striking your head on the ice that causes concussions. It's more often than not, it's fights.
That's right. Often it's something simple as a check. Fights, certainly, but I don't think people realize that if you have two 200-pound guys going at a rapid rate and they collide with each other, the movement, the jostling of the brain is very significant.
We've talked about players' injuries on the ice. You've cared, though, for them through their illnesses off the ice as well. What would you say has been your most emotional experience with a player?
The most serious illness I ever treated in a player was Sako Koivu, who had a type of lymphoma, getting him back on the ice at the end of the season. The day we got him back on the ice and he got a long-standing ovation was maybe the most emotional experience and most satisfying experience I've had as a team physician.
Well, the ovation continued through the anthem. Now we're getting to hockey.
Not yet.
You know, the whole thing started with training camp. Think of the circumstances. It was the day of 9/11 in New York. And we were all overwhelmed with watching the TV. And Sacco came in. He said he'd eaten some bad food on the plane coming over, and he had a pain in his abdomen. We did an ultrasound of his abdomen. He had a lot of fluid in the pelvis, and he had peritoneal tenderness. But he had little implants on the small bowel. And we all, the radiologist said, this is metastatic carcinoma. So we wanted to send the tissue away. No one would fly anything anywhere because of the 9/11. So we finally got sections to the U.S. and to London, England. And everybody agreed on a chemotherapy regime. And he was a warrior in terms of the treatment. It was tough treatment. He had lost all his hair. And he had chemo and radiation.
And he made it back.
And he made it back as a player, and he made it back, and we had the good fortune to go over to Turku, to his hometown, and attend his wedding, which was an incredible experience.
It must have been an emotional experience.
It was. We were, and especially to meet his parents, his grandmother, and his whole family. It was really very special.
You were the team doctor when the Habs last won the Stanley Cup, Canada's last Stanley Cup in 1993. What was that like?
Oh, that was, I've had 9 Stanley Cups, so that was my last.
And now a 24th Stanley Cup banner will hang from the rafters of the famous Forum in Montreal. The Canadians win the Stanley Cup.
Probably one of the most exciting because, there were so many overtime games. There were the stick measurement incident.
It's a 2-minute penalty to LA if it's illegal, and it's a 2-minute penalty to Montreal if it's fair. And Marty McSorley, if he uses an illegal stick, which he did.
They measured his stick and got a penalty, and we got a goal, and just everything about it was very exciting.
You've been practicing for 60 years? What's one guiding principle that has been with you all of that time?
I guess John Beliveau's advice. Always do what's best for the player. And that works for patients, too. Always do what's best for the patient. That goes back to Hippocrates.
And sometimes you need a backbone for that because what's best for the patient might not be apparent as being best for the patient.
Right, and it might not be appealing to the management.
You're getting the accolades right now as you venture into retirement, but the team is always important. The team around you,
absolutely, and nothing I could have done could have been done without the team. The team in the rink. We always have a team of 6 or 8 docs at the rink, but maybe more importantly, I have the ability to call on anybody at the MGH or McGill University to solve any kind of problem that I've encountered. Maybe the biggest lesson I've learned from playing team sports, I played hockey myself, and from looking after the Montreal Canadiens, is that I treat every operation now as a team sport. We have an anesthesiologist, we have a circulating nurse, and nothing gets done well unless we have the whole team on side. So there's nothing more important than the team concept.
It's a great way to end our conversation. Congratulations on your career, I wish you all the best in your retirement, and I'm sure you will continue to be a hockey fan.
I will, for sure. I still enjoy watching. I'm going to watch the game tonight.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, pleasure. Good to speak to a doctor.
Doctor to doctor. Before I left, Dr. Mulder took me to the trauma center at Montreal General Hospital that now proudly bears his name. That's our show this week. Our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. If you like this episode, please give us a rating and review wherever you listen. Make sure to check out our exclusive podcast interview with Trent McCleary, about what that life-saving night back in 2000 was like for him. This edition was produced by Jennifer Warren and our senior producer, Colleen Ross, with help from Samir Chabra. Our digital producer this week is Adam Killick. Our web writer is Mohamed Rashini. Special thanks this week to Susan McKenzie and colleagues at CBC Montreal. That's medicine from my side of the gurney and the rink, at least for this week. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.